Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With us this week, Chris Larimer, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. He's in our Cedar Falls studio. Welcome back to you, Chris.
Thank you, Ben. Good to be here.
Rachel Caulfield is in our Des Moines studio, professor of political science at Drake University. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Ben. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Want to make sure our listeners feel they can join in this hour as we discuss a number of political issues, as we like to do on Politics Wednesdays. 1-866-780-9100. Later in the hour, we'll talk about our Governor Kim Reynolds wielding her veto pen in a couple of instances, what that was about. Also, the continued holdup in Congress over disaster aid, also those struck by a flood disaster here in the Midwest. Senator Joni Ernst breaks with the president on North Korea's missile tests and the Supreme Court sidestepping the abortion issue for now. But first of all, we absolutely want to talk about what just happened within the last 2 hours in the special counsel Robert Mueller making a rare public statement about his investigation. We want to find out what our analysts think this means for the Russia probe. I want to find out what you think and what should come next. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Well, let's listen to a couple of excerpts from that short press conference that Bob Mueller gave. This is the first public comments on the Russia investigation of the 2016 election since Bob Mueller took over the inquiry 2 years ago.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so. We did not, however, make a determination as to whether the president did commit a crime. The introduction to the volume 2 of our report explains that decision. It explains that under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited.
Okay, Bob Mueller went on to talk about, though, the possibility of an investigation of the sitting president.
First, the opinion explicitly permits the investigation of a sitting president because it is important to preserve evidence while memories are fresh and documents available. Among other things, that evidence could be used if there were co-conspirators who could be charged now. And second, the opinion says that the Constitution requires a process other than the criminal justice system to formally accuse a sitting president of wrongdoing.
Join our conversation. What do you make of the statement by Bob Mueller this morning? What should come next? 1-866-780-9100, river-to-river at iowapublicradio.org. Rachel Caulfield, in those couple of clips, or perhaps in other parts that you want to reference, what do you make of Bob Mueller's statement today?
Well, first of all, it's really a special day when we hear from Bob Mueller.
Been talking about it long enough, haven't we?
Yeah, really. Look, I think his statement is it's exactly what House Democrats want to hear right now. It's basically welcoming a process of impeachment, and that's a process that legally could be important for other reasons. Namely, it could give a quote-unquote legitimate legislative purpose to the subpoenas that the House has been serving on senior-level White House officials, and the White House has spurned those requests so far, saying that Congress lacks a legitimate legislative purpose. So I think now this statement reinforces the idea that impeachment legally as well as politically is almost— I mean, it's almost an institutional imperative for the House of Representatives.
Mm-hmm. Chris, did you hear that as well?
I did. I think, you know, that first statement you played was exactly what, as Rachel said, House Democrats wanted to hear and what they're going to be talking about for the next several days and weeks, because he essentially laid it out and said it is up to Congress what they want, how this proceeds next, right? That it's up to Congress if they want to pursue articles of impeachment. The House and the Senate have those powers. as laid out in the Constitution. And he said he went as far as he could, and their investigative team went as far as they could. But now that it is essentially up to Congress at this point. I think one of the other things that was interesting was his reference to interference in the election by interference in the 2016 election by Russia.
Mm-hmm.
He was very clear that there was interference, that it was, as he said, to damage a particular candidate. I think, you know, going forward, what will be interesting to watch is how the Trump administration talks about this, how members of Congress talk about this, and whether they try to approach election reform. Not long after the speech this morning, YouGov re-released some results of a poll they took earlier this month, and the question was just a true or not true of Russia interfered with the 2016 presidential election. 86% of Democrats think that is definitely or probably true, whereas only 40% of Republicans think so.
Mm-hmm.
So public opinion on that particular part of this investigation is pretty well set in stone. But now you have Bob Mueller himself coming out and saying, yes, there was interference, and yes, it was directed to damage a particular candidate.
Join our conversation with Chris Larimer and Rachel Caulfield, our political scientists, this Politics Wednesday, 1-866-780-9100. Steve in the Des Moines area dialed 1-866-780-9100. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I wanted to ask about Mueller's statement that it is unconstitutional to indict a sitting president with a federal crime. I don't know of any Supreme Court case ruling on that, and that could just be my own ignorance, but I thought it was just a Department of Justice policy. Does the panel have any specific knowledge about the Supreme Court rulings on that issue?
Good question, Steve. Rachel or Chris, jump in there.
Yeah, this is longstanding Justice Department policy, and what Mueller made clear was that as he was operating within the Department of Justice, he felt compelled to follow that policy.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think, you know, if you're thinking about it in terms of impeachment, right, it's very clear in Article 1 of the Constitution that it starts with the House and it ends with the Senate. I mean, that's, you know, Sections 2 and 3 of Article 1 of the Constitution lay out that the impeachment process is up to Congress.
Right. And so we aren't interpreted this way, that because of this Justice Department policy, that any sitting president could commit or could not be charged with any federal crime at all by our traditional process here. It has to go through our political wing, our impeachment process.
That's certainly the interpretation that's been given to it in this instance.
Okay.
Whether or not future Department of Justice policy and or future special counsels choose to understand it in the same way, that's a different question.
Okay, let's go back to another excerpt from Bob Mueller this morning. Robert Mueller suggested he was reluctant to testify before Congress.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report. It contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We chose those words carefully, and the work speaks for itself. And the report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
So, Chris, do you think Democrats in the House will heed that call for no testimony, or will it be ignored?
Well, I think they'd still like him to testify. I don't know that they'll be able to get him there. But I think this also fits with what we know about Robert Mueller's personality, is that he is unbelievably professional, that he tries to avoid the politics of this. And any sort of testimony is just going to get swept up in the politics surrounding this investigation. And it becomes sort of this circus, you know, when he would arrive on Capitol Hill. And so I think he's trying to avoid that. He's trying to avoid the politicking around it, the bickering around it, and just leave his research as it is.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this statement today settles anything, Rachel, that we didn't know 3 hours ago, 4 hours ago?
Oh, I, you know, Robert Mueller has been a really interesting figure in all of this, and he's kind of a peculiar figure in American politics at the moment, precisely because, as Chris said, he's actively trying to avoid the politics of this. Mm-hmm. And so many people are really leaning into the politics of this, right? And he has remained separate. And I think, you know, in his mind, and I think he's right about this, that adds legitimacy and dignity to the work that he has produced. Will it change a lot of minds, his press conference today? I don't think it will. I think it's interesting that it happened while Bob Barr was out of the office. He's in Alaska today.
Right.
It happened while the House is in recess.
Right.
Like, so that kind of usual Washington buzz, that kind of concentration of political people, all of whom have political motives. Mm-hmm. This was a day when that was eased a little bit for him.
Well, I know someone
and I find
with
that curious.
Yeah, I know someone with a Twitter account who will be weighing in the coming hours, undoubtedly, right?
Yeah.
And if he hasn't
already. A few
people already
with Twitter accounts have already done it.
I didn't hear any reference to the Attorney General, William Barr, characterized the 448-page report in a very controversial way in four pages. Did we hear any reference to the Attorney General's characterization of this lengthy report today? I didn't.
No, there was a very brief mention of him at the very end of the statement where Robert Mueller basically said, you know, I handed it over. He chose to make it public. And that was it. But that interim step of summarizing and making that final determination to not charge the president, none of that was mentioned today.
Okay. Perhaps our caller will comment or question will bring us back to this topic a little bit later in the hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's move to some Iowa news. Let's talk about a bill that the Republican-controlled Congress nearly unanimously approved in March, and the Republican majority Senate here in Iowa finalized it on the last day of the session in late April. It was a bill that reached a Republican governor's desk and was vetoed on Friday. Governor Kim Reynolds, shortly before the start of the Memorial Day weekend, vetoed legislation that would have expanded Iowa's medical marijuana program. She says she wasn't comfortable with the significant increase in potency and noted the state's medical marijuana advisory board proposed a lower limit.
I have to balance the health and safety of all Iowans with a program that's providing some alternatives to individuals that feel that it is making a difference. And I have heard stories of the difference that it does make.
So, Chris, let me turn to you. How much of a surprise was this?
This was certainly more of a surprise than her previous veto dealing with the powers of the Attorney General. I mean, because as you said, this was a bipartisan piece of legislation. It passed the Iowa Senate on a vote of 40-7, the Iowa House on a vote of 96-3. So very much a bipartisan piece of legislation. As you mentioned, it was increasing the THC levels, the chemical and medical marijuana, that up to from the 3% limit up to 25 grams in 90 days. But as you read more about this, there was also some pushback from the Iowa Medical Cannabis Oil Board. They had comments that were they're a little bit skeptical of the legislation. But on the other hand, again, it was bipartisan. You had over 1,000 people signing a petition saying the governor should sign the bill, and she used her veto power to push it back. Which again, to me, this is more surprising than the veto of the bill with the Attorney General. With that piece of legislation, with the veto on the Attorney General bill, you know, that was very much a partisan piece of legislation. It was entirely a partisan vote. And again, this was a bill that was basically saying the Attorney General had to get the permission of the governor before he would sign on to any out-of-state lawsuit. It was seen as sort of an overreach of power by the legislature going over the checks and balances that we have set up. And, you know, there was pushback from other Democrats and even other Republican attorney generals around the country. The cannabis oil one is a bit puzzling.
Mm. Okay. Especially, Chris, would you agree, considering what we're seeing as the direction of many states in the country, the trend is definitely by states to ease restrictions on the use of medical marijuana and even recreational marijuana.
Yeah, it is. That is absolutely the trend. It's expanding medical marijuana access and allowable use. And so this was a bit surprising. But again, it gets back to the broader argument. And I know we've discussed this before, is, you know, just because your party controls state government, that doesn't mean governing is going to be easy. And in fact, in many cases, it can be harder because there is no break. There is no stopping point in the legislative process. When you have divided government, when you have one party that controls one house and another party that controls the other house, there's at least a break on any sort of extreme piece of legislation. When your party has unified control, all that extreme pieces of legislation can end up on your desk. And you as governor have to make a decision about whether or not to sign the bill and agree with your party, but perhaps upset a large part of the state, or veto that and basically issue a very public declaration saying you don't agree with the leaders within your own party.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the other veto that you referenced last mm-hmm. Wednesday. The governor vetoed legislation that would have limited the powers of the attorney general's office. A veto in exchange for a promise from the current attorney general, Tom Miller, a promise to seek the governor's permission before filing some lawsuits. I spoke with our state attorney general last week. He says he reached a compromise with the governor that limits his ability to join lawsuits the Republican-controlled legislature and governor do not support.
Generally, we will not be able to sue the Trump administration as a result of this agreement. Any agreement has concessions and has pluses and minuses, and this is what I needed to agree to accomplish the ability to file cases in my name and be able to do comments to the federal agencies like the Secretary of Education concerning student loans and for-profit colleges.
That's interesting. At Iowa Public Radio, that entire interview I did with Tom Miller, our attorney general, is online. You can download it. But it was the picture I got was that the attorney general was entered in discussions with the governor and her staff. And he wouldn't say it this way, but it sounds like we will pass this bill unless you agree to this deal, Attorney General. Chris, is that what you saw there? My way, I'll offer you this deal, or you'll get the much worse bill that my Republican majority has passed.
Yeah, I think that's how I've read it. He's no longer required to get permission, but he does need to get consent from the governor to go ahead with these out-of-state lawsuits. And so, yeah, it is still limiting his power, but it's not as limiting as it could be.
Mm-hmm. So, Rachel, this was a compromise reached under the threat of a codified restriction on the attorney general's power. Sort of a compromise under duress here.
I was going to say, I don't know what the difference between consent and permission is, but
I don't know what this all sounds like to you. But anyway. The Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Rachel Caulfield with us of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Let's talk a little bit about, since we've had such severe weather here, let's talk about the severe weather and the politics of severe weather. Yesterday, we set a record as the 12th consecutive day the U.S. did with at least 8 tornado reports. This, according to the National Weather Service, more than 500 tornadoes have been reported in a 30-day period, an unusually high number. And against this backdrop, the politics continue to hold up in Congress over a massive $19 billion spending bill to provide relief to farmers, victims of flooding, tornadoes, hurricanes in all parts of the country. I guess late last week, this is before the Memorial Day holiday weekend, Congress going back to their home districts for the week, appearing, though, to have this disaster aid on its way to pass, the Senate voting 85-8 on Thursday of last week, sending the bill to the House. So far, so good, you think? Lots of House members are gone, so the Democratic majority tried to pass a unanimous consent that would have avoided this, you know, roll call vote. But then a Republican representative, Chip Roy, objected on Friday afternoon. And then the measure was brought up again on Tuesday. Representative Thomas Massie of Kentucky, a Republican, blocked it. Rachel, what to make of all this? Why block legislation that provides much-needed relief dollars to victims of natural disasters, including many here in the Midwest.
Well, so over time, there has been this increasing politicization of what we used to consider to be must-pass bills. And disaster relief has always been kind of seen as that category of legislation that no member of Congress wants to vote against, particularly because disaster relief typically crosses state boundaries and impacts a lot of constituencies in a lot of different states. And so members of Congress know that if their state isn't affected right now, it might be affected in a subsequent natural disaster. And so they don't want to be the ones voting against it. This bill really started last fall, and it has faced continued controversies. And the most notable have been fights about disaster relief for the disaster relief for the border, because Donald Trump tried to include border wall funding and then also disaster relief for Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump in particular alleged that the government of Puerto Rico had not adequately satisfied his concerns about mismanagement of disaster relief funds. And so they've been negotiating this on and off during this time period. This seemed to be the final step. And the bill that was finally put on the table, this $19 billion bill, which sounds like a lot of money, but it's actually not that much money within the federal budget, and would do tremendous amounts of good across any number of different states. It seemed to come together. Some objections, substantive objections, seemed to be lifted. The debate about the border wall was kind of removed from this particular bill. They thought they had it all wrapped up with a bow and ready to go.
Right.
And in the end, these two members of the House, it's very rare that individual members of the House get to exercise this kind of veto-like authority over legislation. But the unanimous consent process allows them to do that.
So if they would have unanimous consent is all in favor, say yay and then mm-hmm. nay, and then we don't do any individual counting.
It means they don't
and
have to
any
do
any one
roll
member
call
can
vote.
Can throw a wrench into that.
They have to have unanimous consent for those who are actually
as
present.
As the name indicates.
That's right, exactly.
Okay. So very quickly, we're going to go to break. Rachel, what do you see in the future of this disaster aid, $19 billion?
I think members of Congress come back from recess, and they do it through a typical legislative process, and it passes no problem.
Okay. No problem in conjunction with Congress. I don't believe you just said that.
Imagine
that. All right. Rachel Caulfield will be back. Rachel, no problem, Caulfield of Drake University will be back. Professor of Political Science there. Chris Larimer, Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Invite your contributions, your thoughts, your questions. 1-866-780-9100. It's Politics Wednesday. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield and Chris Larimer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer with Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, our two political analysts. We'd like you to join our conversation on any of the topics that we have today. We talked about Bob Mueller's statement, his first statement since the beginning of his two-year-long investigation into the 2016 presidential election. 1-866-780-9100. In just a few minutes, we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and abortion rulings. You're welcome to join us with your questions, your comments. 1-866-780-9100. Back to some state news. We heard in our news there at the bottom of the hour, the Democrats in the state are calling for a special session of our legislature to override the veto by the governor of medical marijuana. Interesting there. Doug in Rockwell City emailing us with this question. Has there been any talk in Des Moines about the legalization of recreational marijuana to fund education and mental health? If not, will you discuss it, Doug, in Rockwell City? Chris, what do you think about that idea? How far is Iowa away from the states that have legalized marijuana?
Well, I think given the political control of the state right now, I think we're still a ways out as far as passing something that would allow for full-on recreational marijuana. That's not to say that we will not continue to take, you know, incremental steps in that direction. That's, again, why that the veto was a bit surprising, because it was another incremental step in just dealing with medical marijuana, including expanding who's eligible for treatment, the type of pain that can be treated with it, who can provide that prescription in terms of allowing nurses' assistants and to be able to do that. So I would expect that we would continue to take incremental steps. I think, you know, if we would see a change in political control, then you might see a more of a significant policy shift in that direction. But I would expect states to continue to move in that direction, some faster than others, depending on the politics of the state.
Mm-hmm. Just a signal sent out with a call for this special session by Democrats, not a likelihood, since they're in the minority, that this will happen.
Yeah, I'd be a little bit surprised, because it would also require Republicans to be on board with that. And I think, you know, for them to push back that hard against their own governor would be quite a shock. And if I could, just going back to the discussion we had right before the break, I think Rachel's right that in terms of the delay on the disaster aid bill in Congress. I think Rachel's right. I think once they reconvene after the recess, they come back, they'll pass that bill.
Mm-hmm.
But I think more generally, this is exactly the type of thing that feeds into the public's frustration with Congress. You know, the outcome at the end of the day is probably going to be one that's favorable in terms of getting that disaster aid bill passed. But it's this process of slowing something down that everybody should be on board with, that everybody can agree on is a good thing in terms of helping other people out around the country that have faced natural disasters, and yet Congress can't even do that. It's those procedural things that are really driving the frustration behind Congress and why people are so upset. Because if you start to politicize disaster aid, and this has been going back to even Hurricane Sandy in 2012, then what can Congress even do if they can't get disaster aid right?
Right. Okay. Are there any bills, any areas that are, what did you call them, consensus areas, Rachel, that we just agree also with our partisanship that this has to happen?
Well, disaster relief has always been one of the biggest categories of quote-unquote must-pass legislation. In the past, one of the things that Congress did in order to find agreement on things is they would pack bills with specific projects for different constituencies around the country, i.e. earmarks. Really would bring people on board and would facilitate agreement. And with the elimination of earmarks, that has really hurt Congress's ability to construct legislation. We used to call them Christmas tree bills, because there was something for everybody on that bill.
Mm-hmm. A little bit of if you didn't want to sign the bill as a member of Congress, if you didn't want to sign the bill, you could tout this little Christmas tree present for your constituency, and everything would be smoothed over.
And so people could feel better about cooperating and coming together on, mm-hmm. on specific bills. And bills that are quote-unquote redistributive in nature, meaning that they take government funds and distribute them to various projects around the country, were particularly good for that. So something like infrastructure would have been an ideal candidate for becoming a must-pass bill.
Or the
farm bill, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so increasingly, as those mechanisms to grease the wheels have gone away, Congress has had a harder time coming to consensus on some of these big picture policy questions.
Okay. Let's go back to the Mueller statement from this morning. Jerry writing to us, please respond to this. I don't really understand how Mueller is being apolitical in his actions. Why didn't he make a statement when they issued the abbreviated report? He could have noted that there is a longstanding Justice Department policy regarding their relationship and role of the department regarding the commander-in-chief. Instead, he left everyone thrashing about for months. Well, it's been about a month, actually. In increasingly polarizing confusion, I feel a bit resentful, writes Jerry. It seems to me his actions exacerbate emotions and opinions and further muddies the context around the important issue of election interference. Chris, what do you think about that? Jerry, clearly a bit upset, angry.
I certainly understand Jerry's frustration, and I think that he's not the only one who shares that frustration. I think for a lot of people who have really followed this, they are really dug in on this. We know how partisan people's views are on this issue, and how people's perceptions of the investigation fall very neatly along partisan lines, right? Going back to that poll that I mentioned at the beginning of the show. And so I think both sides want to see some sort of statement that either, you know, really accuses the other side and is very explicit about that mm-hmm. accusation, or clears the other side. And you're not going to get that from Robert Mueller. That's not his role. That's not how he conducts investigations. He is trying to stay as nonpartisan as possible. But the problem is that people are so emotional about this investigation at this point, they really want him to kind of come out and give them the final word rather than kicking it back to Congress, where we know it's just going to be the back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to caller. Mary has been waiting. She's calling from Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I think Mueller's timing was perfect. Congress is on recess, so that they're going around their little towns, and they're going to get an earful when they come back, because everybody was listening, especially me, because I see this as a soap opera, how it's peeling and peeling and peeling. And Mueller, he's cool, so that he's believable, and he was still working for the Department of Justice, so he gave what he found. Mm-hmm. And he was one mistake he made. He said that it was unconstitutional to charge a sitting president. So that way he threw it back to Congress, because high crimes and misdemeanors are their job. And so we got to start studying the Constitution and paying attention. As for Mr. Mueller getting insulted by the governor, I see Mr. Mueller as my hero.
Iowa's attorney general. Back to that story. Yes. Switching topics
yes.
there.
He's going to have to fight that opioid case for the state of Iowa. Yeah. And then back to Mueller, everybody can make their complaints to their senators. We have no senators here. Both of our senators are Koch senators. So who are we going to complain to about what Mueller said about the election? We have no rights here in the state of Iowa.
Mary, thank you very much for your view from Iowa City. Time running out with our analysts, Chris Larimer and Rachel Caulfield. Let's move on to the Supreme Court sidestepping an abortion case that could have given the high court its first chance to consider abortion restrictions since the arrival of the newest justice, Justice Brett Kavanaugh. The justices have turned down an appeal to reinstate an Indiana law banning abortions sought solely because of the sex or disability of a fetus, but they upheld part of the same law requiring burial or cremation of fetal remains. Rachel, your thoughts on this and why it matters?
Well, this is kind of the first step in what is going to be a very, very, very long process, I suspect. So we are seeing around the country, of course, we're seeing states now enacting much more stringent restrictions on abortion, including state legislative efforts to ban abortion entirely in their state, most notably Alabama's most recent on that front. We're seeing Missouri bring this case against their one remaining abortion clinic, which could very well close on Friday. So we're seeing this kind of ongoing state-based effort to restrict access to abortion. The Indiana law was passed while Vice President Mike Pence was governor of Indiana. And this was an effort to restrict the basis for abortion, and then furthermore to ensure that fetal remains had to be buried or cremated, which is consistent with state law for human remains more generally.
Mm-hmm.
And this Supreme Court decision was procedurally really interesting as well. The court declined to hear the case but issued this 3-page decision unsigned. And yet Clarence Thomas did file a 20-page dissent from the court's decision.
We know it wasn't him.
Right. So, like, it's an interesting example of the court kind of very tepidly wading into discussions of the issue without wanting to take giant leaps. So basically what the court said is, we will absolutely accept the new rules regarding burial or cremation of fetal remains, but we are not going to hear the challenge. We're not going to even consider the case regarding a woman's reasons for having an abortion. there will be now a whole string of cases that make it to the Supreme Court, and those laws are being passed explicitly for the purpose of going to the Supreme Court. Conservative lawmakers and pro-life groups believe that the court is now positioned to overturn Roe v. Wade and perhaps more importantly, Planned Parenthood v. Casey. And so they're explicitly aiming to challenge those cases. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of the opening case. I think we're going to have several years now where we have litigation continuing through our court system and moving up to the Supreme Court.
It's interesting analysis over the past few weeks that that John Roberts, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, would not want to tackle Roe v. Wade, overturn it head on here, but in bits and pieces. Rachel, do you agree with that analysis as well?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. John Roberts has always been known as an institutionalist. He really values the institutional legitimacy of the Supreme Court. And part of that in his mind, I think, is to position the court as an incremental change maker, never moving too far outside the bounds of public opinion and or the policy preferences of Congress or the president or state legislatures, for that matter.
Other Supreme Court news we've had in the last few days, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, said that that Republicans would confirm a justice to the Supreme Court if a vacancy came up in 2020. Now, remember, 3 years ago, it was Mitch McConnell who denied a hearing to former President Barack Obama's nominee, saying it was traditional in election years to keep the seat open until a new president could be inaugurated. Let's listen to Mitch McConnell. This was at a Chamber of Commerce meeting in Paducah, Kentucky. That's his home state, Kentucky. The Senate Majority Leader was asked what Senate Republicans would do if there was a vacancy in the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020.
How are we doing? Yeah, you know, the reason I started with the judges, as important as all these other things are that we're talking about, I mean, you want to have a long-lasting, positive impact on the country. Everything else changes. You know, I remember during the tax bill, there were people agonizing over whether one part of the tax bill was permanent or not. I said, look, the only way the tax bill is permanent depends upon the next election. Because people have different views about taxes in the two parties and approach it differently when they get in power. What can't be undone is a lifetime appointment to a young man or woman who believes in the quaint notion that the job of the judge is a fallen law. So that's the most important thing we've done for the country, which cannot be undone.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a little hard to hear there. His first words, oh, we'd fill it. Chris Larimer, speaking of the hypothetical at this point, vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court in 2020. Democrats accusing the majority leader of hypocrisy. Is there another way to see this?
No. I think
political expediency.
Right. And you know, there were holes in that argument when it was made in 2016 in terms of never doing that in election year. But I think that video in particular and that line that we'd fill it, I think you're going to see both Democrats and Republicans use that heading into the 2020 campaign. I mean, to the extent that, you know, the issue of abortion stays a topic, and I agree with Rachel, it is going to continue. You're going to continue to see cases trying to reach the Supreme Court on the issue of abortion. That video, the topic of the next Supreme Court justice, is probably going to be pretty salient to the 2020 presidential campaign. I mean, we always talk about how emotional abortion is and how, unlike other opinions on other issues such as a same-sex marriage or even medical marijuana or even recreational marijuana, where we've seen some evolution on attitudes, abortion is one where it's relatively stable. Now, there's been some movement in recent years on different aspects of it, different rules related to it, but it's generally one of those opinions that's relatively stable. And so that's one that can be a motivating factor for the electorate. I mean, you can think back to the 2016 election when this was an issue of Supreme Court filling that vacancy. There were voters you would hear who would say, well, they weren't all that thrilled about Donald Trump, but they felt like they would rather have him picking the next Supreme Court justice than Hillary Clinton. And so I think that video is going to be used by both sides going into the 2020 election.
Mm-hmm. Interesting also, of course, at that time, the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Charles Grassley, mm-hmm. Working together with Mitch McConnell in denying then President Obama's nominee. Rachel Caulfield, will that in any way haunt Senator Grassley? Do you expect him to be as practical as Mitch McConnell is in saying, yeah, sure, if there's a vacancy, we'll grab it, well, as long as we have the power?
If the Republicans have a chance to put a third Trump appointee on the U.S. Supreme Court, they're going to take it.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest problem in all of this is that they've tried to make this an argument about principle. It is not an argument about principle, and it never has been. It is pure political expediency. They did not stall on Merrick Garland's nomination because of any principled notion of the people deciding a presidential election. To try to give them the benefit of that doubt, I think, is completely unrealistic. Democrats presumably would have done a very similar thing if they were in a similar position.
Mm-hmm. Chris Larimer, what are your thoughts about Senator Grassley now given McConnell's statement?
Well, you know, I don't think it's going to hurt him for a couple of reasons. Obviously, he's moved on to the Senate Finance Committee and chairing mm-hmm. that, but he's also not up for reelection until 2022. And so you may see some video clips of him making various statements from the 2016 election and dealing with filling that vacancy. But I don't think it's going to hurt him in the long run. I'd be very surprised if it does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have got a couple minutes left. I'd like to, in closing, have you look out on our caucus campaign landscape and tell us what you see. Rachel, you first. What are you seeing in terms of the 2020 perhaps polling on the candidates? Who's got some momentum? Who's grabbing the issues and the headlines?
Well, it's been interesting in the past few days. We seem to have entered into a new phase for these candidates where they really are trying to formulate and put out policy positions, much more detailed policy than they have in the past. So I think we've kind of entered a new effort to distinguish themselves based on policy. Joe Biden put out his first major policy program, which is about education. Beto O'Rourke just put out a major immigration policy proposal. Elizabeth Warren, of course, has been putting out policy proposals for the entirety of her campaign so far. So I think what we're going to be seeing is much more detailed policy-based conversation now about how the candidates are distinguishing themselves from each other. And right now, I think that given such a huge field of candidates, that could potentially lead to some significant disagreements. And I think that the party itself and voters need to navigate this phase pretty carefully.
Chris?
Yeah, I think Rachel's right. You are seeing a lot of attempts to put out policies. And I think a lot of that is directed at trying to separate themselves from Joe Biden, right? I mean, if you look at the polling right now, he's out in front. And
he's like the 800-pound gorilla.
Right, very, very large, sizable lead in most polling surrounding the Democratic nomination. And so I think what these candidates are doing is trying to figure out what are the different things we can do to try to catch Joe Biden? How do we get some momentum? How do we at least move into that second or third spot so we can at least be considered in that top tier? So when it comes to the debate time or how are we going to raise more money or how are we going to get any sort of endorsements from Congress, how are we going to do that? How do we separate ourselves? How are we viewed as sort of an alternative leader besides Joe Biden? And so I think they may not say it, but I think most of the Democratic candidates seem to be scrambling and trying to come up with ways to at least get into that top tier.
Right. And in a specific example of policy, you brought up, Rachel, we were talking about the Supreme Court and abortion. Yesterday, Senator Kamala Harris of California outlining a proposal that would require states and localities with a history of unconstitutionally restricting abortion rights, in her words, to obtain federal approval before such laws can take effect. So, Rachel, that's exactly what you mean.
That's exactly what I mean. So this is one of those situations. She's borrowing a concept from the Voting Rights Act that required states with a history of voting discrimination to pre-clear any sort of change in their voting laws with the Justice Department. And so that idea then would be transferred onto protection of abortion rights. And this is, in her mind, a way for her to distinguish herself from the other Democrats in the field, all of whom support abortion rights, right?
Okay, right. We've got to wrap this up. Rachel Caulfield, professor of political science at Drake University, in our Des Moines studio. Chris Larimer in Cedar Falls, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. You two make an awesome team. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Caitlin Harrop. We also had help from Stephanie Nobriga today, Chris Fenton in Cedar Falls, John Pemble in Des Moines. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.